The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 496 for Sunday, April 6th, 2014.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We share your questions. We try to answer your questions. We share your tips and your cool stuff found. And together, we all try to learn at least a little something new about the Mac, Apple, and other technological, that's a word? It sure is now.
It's easy for you to say.
Advancements. That's right. This show is sponsored by Smile at smilesoftware.com and also by iFixit at ifixit.com/MGG. With coupon code MGG that gets you $10 off a purchase of $50 or more. We will talk about them. We will talk about Smile later on in the show. For now, here in Durham, New Hampshire, back in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And yes, here, back. Oh, thank goodness. No. In Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
And here with a sore back in Durham, New Hampshire, is Pilot Pete. Thanks for having me, guys.
Too much flying, Pete?
Well, too much riding in the cockpit on the jump seat back from Mackerel.
Oh, that's right.
I took the red eye on the jump. I'll tell you what, a coach seat would have been comfortable. I was jammed up in a tiny cockpit with three other guys in an Airbus 319, the baby bus. Long, painful night.
And being that you were in the jump seat, a cocktail was not an option for you.
Not even close.
That's right. No. Yeah. That's too bad. Well, I'm glad you made it out finally to Macworld Expo.
It was an absolute ball. Thanks for having me and helping me get out there. And that was neat. Anybody listening that hasn't gone, if you ever have the opportunity, well worth it. It's not an iPhone case show. We had that bad rep for a while, but I absolutely loved meeting all the people that do this podcasting that are tech experts and the whole community. Everybody's friendly.
It's true.
I didn't meet a tech snob in the bunch, so to speak.
Yeah, it's all, everybody's kind of open arms.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's good. It is kind of kumbaya-ish. Yeah. No,
if you travel in the right circles, I would say, but the problem is the circles span far and wide as far as
people
that we normally hang out with, but also new people I met.
Yeah. I don't know that there's any bad. I haven't encountered any bad circles there.
Oh, there has to be one somewhere.
I'm not sure
I don't know about them.
Well, John's kind of a tech snob, but
that's right. Oh, John's circles.
No, but I guess my only reflection, and then Dave, you have some reflections too. My only reflection is that it seemed there wasn't quite as much activity. Not to say that nothing was happening, but I just got the sense, but I'll spit it out, that the attendance was lower than in the past.
Huh. Yeah, I haven't seen numbers.
The other day, Thursday, it seemed that it was kind of empty. And then Friday was busier, which kind of surprised me because I would think Thursday and Friday would be the least busy because it's during the week. And then Saturday would have been the big day.
Yeah. I
kind of got that feeling, and other people kind of echoed that. On the other hand, I talked to some vendors, and they were like, dude, we've gotten so much traffic. So
yeah. Yeah, it's, I mentioned several times, but that the vendors, that it would probably be tough for vendors to justify their time and their booth and all of that on the expo floor in terms of, a direct ROI, right? But I've said, and I still maintain this, that the vendors at that show, I look at them at least at some level as the sponsors of that show. And without them, that conference couldn't happen at that level. Because listen, you're getting in to a conference for $100 for a conference pass. That should be a $1,200 conference pass.
Sure.
Is what that should be. I mean, for the space and for, all the people that organize it and all that stuff, but it's not, so it's heavily subsidized by the expo floor. However, and that's how I felt going in it. And to a degree, I feel that way coming out of it. Certainly that's true that they subsidize it. But in terms of the vendors getting something out of it, I talked to a lot of vendors who sort of opened my eyes and they said, we get to talk directly to our customers. And so looking at it from a vendor standpoint, as a market research tool, this now becomes a very valuable thing, because you get the diehards that are coming and want to talk to you about your product. So I was really happy to hear that from a lot of vendors.
That's awesome. Yeah. You know, and I hadn't even thought of that, but
no,
I walked
I
up
either.
To the 1Password booth and I said, guys, I have a feature request, told them what it was, and they went, it's in the works. It'll be out. I'm like, wow, beautiful.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can find that. So it's good on both sides. But
yeah,
that's
right.
awesome. You know,
yeah.
And I guess the other thing, they're competing for the best of show, which gets them a lot of publicity.
It does.
And gets them in the magazine and
yep.
increases sales. So.
Yep. No, it's right. Yeah. So there are these benefits that that I'd sort of overlooked coming into the show. So I wanted to make sure I said something about it. The other thing that, John, you experienced for the first time and I experienced for the first time as a business traveler was we used some alternative travel services, I'll say. The first one was one that we mentioned going in. John, you and I stayed in a guy's apartment. We used Airbnb. Now, the guy wasn't there. He was gone. We rented the whole apartment from him. It was a two-bedroom place. We had two bathrooms, which is awesome. We had a great living room, a great kitchen within walking distance to everything. And we actually rented 3 2-bedroom apartments, one that John and Jeff from Backbeat Media had, and then and one that Brian and Jeff, you know, here at the Mac Observer had. And I really liked it, John. You know, I've done Airbnb with the family. I've done it once on my own where I just rented a guy's apartment last year for South by Southwest. But it was quite pleasant. Even if you and I were doing different things at night or heading back to the place at different times, it was really nice coming back there. And, you know, we're in town for I was there for six nights. And there's always that when you stay in a hotel, there's always that that lonely hotel room blues that you kind of get after. I always get after a little while. And I just didn't experience that this time because, frankly, you were there. Right. You know, we got back. And even if we were both exhausted and we didn't stay up for hours, there was, you know, 10 minutes while we were whatever, you know, getting a snack and you know, just sort of decompressing for the day that we could just chit chat. And I really liked it. In fact, the very last night that, you know, you took off after dinner because you had your flight. And I had the place to myself again, as I did the very first night before you came in. And it was like, oh, it's too bad John's not here. You know, so I liked that. I don't know about you, but maybe I pestered the heck out of you. I don't know. But I liked it. It was good. And it's nice to have a living room to hang out.
And but Dave, you know what I saw, like one morning, I actually saw that there were, you know, additional people you could make friends with, like the guy sleeping on the sidewalk across from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's in Soma, right? So, you know, there's sort of that vibe to Soma, south of Market area in San Francisco, where it's just, I mean, there's a lot of homeless people around. And the weather there is so good that through the winter that. It attracts homeless people. That's just how it works. Yeah.
So this guy wasn't mad that you let homeless people stay the last 3 days after you left?
No. But up until now, he didn't even know.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. And I may actually stay there for WWDC. I've been in touch with the guy.
Oh, nice.
Since then. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I have a question about
perfect,
that.
Perfect. Because, yeah, we were, I think it was on, 6th Street or a little past 6th Street. And all the stuff you need to get to is like on 4th Street.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
we're great.
You know, it was. You know, 15, 20 minute walk at most.
At most. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
If anything, that's good to try to get some of that in every day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I haven't used this service, but it's not like a trade. You don't have to offer your place. You can go on and rent somebody else.
No, you go on. Yeah. What you do is you go online. These people list their places through Airbnb. It costs them for Airbnb. It costs the host nothing. So I go in and let's say the guy said he would, which I think he did, you know, he'd rent us the place for $200 a night. I could be wrong on that number, but I think that's about what we paid, which is great. Right. Because we eat to get our own
mortgage for the month. And
well, that's it. Right. He gets way more than he should. And should is the wrong word. I'm fine paying it because it's way less than we would have paid for a single hotel room, but certainly less than two.
Comparatively,
maybe we paid
$200 is what you're talking at least for a hotel room that's convenient to the Moscone.
Yeah.
And all that.
At least a lot of them were like $270 this year. Yeah. So I think we paid $250. So we paid $250 a night, but that was for the entire apartment, which in addition, as I said, to two bedrooms, two bathrooms, a living room, also has a kitchen, which I really like, you know, being able to just get up in the morning and make your own breakfast without having to go out and, you know, do all that stuff. It's great. But yeah, so if I paid, you know, if we paid him $250 a night, which I think we did, he gets every penny of that $250 minus whatever the credit card fee is. So 3% or something like that. He gets 97% of that. But on top of the $250 a night, we paid, I think it's about $130 for the entire reservation. So one fee to Airbnb. And that's how Airbnb makes money.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. They got to make money. They're
absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's cool.
And okay. They handle the transaction. I, you know, the credit card and all that stuff just goes through Airbnb and it works great.
Well, that's slick. So, yeah. Well, I got one other question then.
Go.
So you're near there, but it, like if it's raining or stuff, how do you get back and forth from the conference?
Well, that's the other piece of travel alternative we used. We made heavy use of Uber this year. And those of you that haven't been in cities or don't know about this, Uber is an alternative to using taxis. And what you do, it initially started to take advantage of all these sort of empty or unused black cars that were always kind of waiting around. So you get an account with Uber, which is free. And if you get it the right way, in fact, I'll put a link in the show notes that you can get a $20 credit when you sign up for Uber. And it's, again, free. And that $20 credit you can use on your first trip. When I signed up, I got a $10 credit, which I used, but now that they're at the moment, anyway, they're offering 20s. So you link your credit card with your Uber account or your PayPal or however you want to pay. And then, you launch the Uber app and it, because you have an iPhone and it can geolocate, it knows where you are and you say, I want a car and you pick whether you want a black car, an SUV, which is a little more expensive, or Uber X, which is actually a little less expensive. And it's not a black car. It's somebody driving their own Prius around or their own whatever. And for the most part, we used Uber X because it was cheaper and it was fine. And the drivers are rated by their passengers and the passengers are rated by their drivers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes.
Be on your behavior.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you throw up in somebody's cab, you're going to get a black mark. As you should.
Oh, man.
Right?
That's already on my permanent record.
That's right, Pete. But yeah. So, you know, you can see that you have what your guy's rated. And so you say, I want to ride. And they say, okay. And it takes maybe 30 seconds and it comes in and says, okay, a driver has agreed. They're on their way. And they show you on the map where the driver is. And then the driver shows up and you tell them where you want to go. Driver takes you where you want to go. Maybe a little chit chat. And when you get there, you say, thanks for the ride. Bye bye. And you walk out of the car, close the door behind you. Cause that's the polite thing to do. And you don't want to get rated poorly, but that's it. Payment is handled. There's no tipping. There's no nothing. Payment is handled inside the app. Totally flawless. It's way better than dealing with a cab.
So quickly.
Yes.
All right. So I'll tell you what I did. So two things. So one, I actually tried. So I installed the Uber app.
Yeah.
And actually tried it here. Every now and then I'll get a quote. More often than not, if I ask for a vehicle, say none available because.
Because you're not really in a city. Right. Right.
But I'm near cities. And the thing is, every now and then, like I tried last night and it said, I think I tried both a black car and an SUV and it did give me one, but it said they're going to be there in about 25 minutes, which to me is they're probably in Stamford. They're probably in one of the major cities.
Yeah.
And they just decided, okay, I'll, you know, advertise myself in a larger radius. Yeah. And if this guy in Fairfield wants me to head on the highway and pick him up. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and the pricing, you know, was kind of up there. You know, I did like, you know, a quote for going from here to the end of the street and it was like $25 and it's like,
sure.
But,
sure. Yeah,
and they expand. And then what I did actually at Macworld, I did, and to me, they're a standby, you know, they're a super shuttle, $17. And they do, now the nice thing is that they do drop off at residential addresses, like the apartment.
Sure.
I wasn't sure of that, if they only did hotels. But they've, you know, I mean.
Yeah, but that's old school. Hey, so there's Uber.
Oh, yeah, they are. You can pay online and all that stuff. Like I did that for the thing back. So, yeah, I mean, the guy just showed up and, you know, I got a phone. I mean, they were still kind of high tech. So we're standing there on the sidewalk. You're waiting with me. And all of a sudden my phone rings and they're like, your driver's here. It's like, oh, that's good. Here he is.
Push notifications. That's what
you get
need.
A picture of your driver and his license plate number and all that. So
with Uber, you do.
And, you know, it's cool.
And so there's Uber, there's Lyft, LYFT, and then there is Sidecar. So there are three services. They all kind of work in the same way, but they each have their own little niches. So, yeah, Airbnb and Uber were the big wins for a lot of us this Macworld.
Yeah, I'll mention my cab ride to the airport from downtown San Francisco was like $36.
on or Uber.
Not cab, on UberX. It was much cheaper.
It was clean,
fast. And the guy, when I got in, I was riding JetBlue coming back, and the guy goes, you know, I don't think that's in the domestic terminal. I think they're in international. I go, no, it's only domestic. You know, you don't understand. He goes, and he made the phone call to a friend and said, let me make sure. So, I mean, this guy's, they're looking out for you. They're doing the best they can. It was awesome of him to make that phone call. And sure enough, he was right. JetBlue, for whatever reason, it was out of the international terminal at SFO. Yeah.
That's awesome.
The only place they had space, I guess. But,
all right, John. So I want to I want to jump into something I learned this week.
Brother,
I think it was you, but it might have been somebody else on Twitter was talking about finding out the contents of a time machine backup and what's going on. And of course, we have some tools and all of that. But a listener hipped or a follower, which I think is a listener, Harold, hipped us to a command I had no idea existed. If you go to the terminal, there is a command called TMUTIL. Which is, as you might guess, time machine utility. And if you type TMUtil, you'll get a big long list of commands. And if you type TMUtil help and a command, then you can get even more details. But he was saying to use TMUtil compare, and you can compare two paths of your backup drive, and it will tell you what the difference is between those. So if you see your drive backing up, you know, 25 gigs of data, and you're not sure what's going on, TMUtil can help you out with that. So I had no idea that this existed. And my guess, of course, is that it's been there forever. And we just didn't know.
We have actually mentioned it recently, Dave. So two things. So number one, I suggested that you should use something that I've used in the past that I don't know if you did, and you found the source of this mystery. Did you?
Well, I'm talking about TMUtil.
Yes.
But yeah.
Because your point was that a backup was taking way more space than you expected.
And now we will explain that. Sure. Yeah. So I was talking on Twitter. The way we got here to TMUtil three levels up was I noticed one of my backups was one of my machines was saying that it wanted to back up 75 gigs worth of data or something. And that's when listener Harold chimed in and said, check out TMUtil, which was cool. I just wanted to quickly mention that TMUtil exists because it's just one of those things folks should know about. But if you have others that exist,
I'm sorry. Okay. Back on track here.
Yeah.
Let's get back to doing this podcast
thing.
No, we recently touched on this because when we were talking about local backups, TMUtil was also the tool that we talked about that would let you not only create a local backup, but enable or disable these local snapshots that we were talking about in the
past. That's right.
We'll give you, so TMUtil is the same utility, but yeah, actually I learned something because as you said, there is a quite a list of things it can do. I'll have to try the compare thing. Cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. So I love it when we find out about stuff like this or that, you know, in the last show it was AF Convert we talked about, but good stuff. All right. Where are we time? You know what I want to do is I want to talk to you about our first sponsor for this show, which is Smile. At smilesoftware.com. And Smile, if you don't know, it's because you're a new listener and that's okay. But Smile's been sponsoring this show for a very, very long time. I know they were our first sponsor here at Mac Geek Gab. But this week, this month, I get to talk about PDF Pen for iPad. Now, PDF Pen is an app that I've used on the Mac for years and have been able to use on the iPad actually now for a couple of years as well. It's an awesome way of manipulating, editing, massaging, and managing PDFs. If you get a PDF in, you can sign, you can add your signature to it. You can add the date to it. You can highlight text. You can edit text. You can add little notes to it. It's an awesome way to just manipulate this kind of stuff. I get contracts in all the time that I need to sign and they come in via PDF. I used to have to print them and sign them and scan them. PDF Pen, either on my Mac or on the road. I do it from my iPad or even my iPhone and it works great. The new version 1.7 of PDF Pen for iPad is out now. It has been updated for all of the iOS 7 goodness that exists. And they, in the process of doing that, they did a massive performance improvement. There were some times when the iPad version would get a little sluggish, and they have wiped all that out now. It syncs via iCloud, Dropbox, and Alfresco. So this way you can run PDF Pen on your Mac and share documents via iCloud again, or Dropbox, or Alfresco. You can, and that sharing is just automatic. You can also retrieve and save PDFs to Dropbox, and also to Evernote, Box, and Google Drive. So you've got all these places that you can read and write to. Of course, this is because Apple doesn't allow direct file system access on iOS, which is frustrating when you're dealing with files like this. So they've just solved it. Any other of those services just works fine. And you can share PDFs with your desktop directly via Wi-Fi, or using iTunes or FTP. And it's even got web dev support. So they have full support now for the pressure sensitive pens, the Pogo Connect, the Jaja, or the Haha, I forget how that's pronounced, and the Jot Touch. So they're really going nuts actually over there, and spending a lot of time with this app and updating it. And I got to meet with some of the folks that are programming it, and it's awesome stuff what they're doing. So check it out. SmileSoftware.com, PDF Pen for iPad. Of course, they also make Text Expander, which you just need to have, and PDF Pen for your Mac as well. So check it out. SmileSoftware.com. All right, John, with that, let's keep going on the tips trail here. And I think jump into James. This is a fascinating thing. So James says, hi, John, Dave, and Pete. You answered a question during your live show at Macworld for someone that wanted to see their photo collection everywhere on all their devices. The tool to do that is baked into the Apple ecosystem. I learned this through a Don McAllister screencast on the subject recently on Screencasts Online. It says, today, shared photo streams inside Apple's ecosystem allow a theoretical maximum of 500,000 pictures or videos. And he says, no, John, that's not crazy talk. Well, it is crazy talk, but it's true, right? He said the way it works is you get 5,000 pictures or videos per shared photo stream, and you can have 100 shared photo streams. What you do is you create a photo stream and then leave the two line blank, thus sharing them with only yourself. And you will, I know it's brilliant, and you will have them available across all of your devices through iCloud. And as opposed to just the 1,000 that you get through your normal photo stream, he says, oh, yeah. And it doesn't count against your iCloud limit, at least not yet. He says, I would
until
they figure it out. Yeah, right. He says, I would have another service as well in case Apple pulls the plug. But this is pretty convenient and might be enough for some. I know. Yeah. Yeah. You just share a photo stream with no one else.
How stupid do you feel for not knowing that?
I know.
That's awesome.
I love it.
That's brilliant.
Go, John.
It gets even better because I came across this because I was researching another question, which you sent me, Dave. It's a photo-related question, but it's a bit deeper than this.
Sure.
But in the course of my discoveries here, I came across this as well. So I was running Aperture. Typically, when you sort your photos in Aperture, you sort them by projects. And the thing is, if you click on a project and you click share within Aperture, you get a number of options. One is iCloud. And then if you click on that, it then has the next menu that comes up is stream. And it's like, which stream would you like to add this to? And the choices are new photo stream or an existing one, or I guess my photo stream is the default, you know, your catch-all photo stream.
Yeah.
So as far as I can see, this is part of an answer to someone who asked the question, well, you know, how do I coordinate or sync my content here? I hadn't really looked at iCloud streams before, but yeah. Aperture, and I would assume that iPhoto as well, support them directly. So yeah, I mean, 500, that's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, I'm assuming that through this interface, I can get up to 500, as with any interface.
5,000, you mean?
Or 5,000, yes.
Yeah, 5,000 per stream. That's right. Yeah, per shared stream. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. What's frustrating is that you have to find this jury rig thing. I'm still really hesitant on Apple and the cloud. They're doing better than they ever have, and yet I'm concerned about them doing doing enough.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's their whole strategy with the cloud is just a little weird.
You know, and I haven't used shared streams before. Just want to mention too, you can go back. If you create it blank, you can go back and add people later.
Of course.
So yeah,
sure.
That's cool. But
yeah.
I just hadn't putzed with that because now when you go to iCloud, you don't, your photo stream isn't there. And if you go to iCloud.com, it kind of isn't there. It's all in your iPhoto and on your devices and that sort of thing. So I hadn't messed with it too much, but that's brilliant. That makes it so much easier.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, it's good stuff. So that's where we're at on that one. All right.
You know, that's a good point, Pete. Yeah, that's always kind of bothered me. The whole, if you go to, because I was like, is it still that way?
Yeah, or if you sign in to iCloud, which I'm doing right now. And get into your photos. They were there.
Yeah, I see mail, contacts, calendar, notes, reminders, find my iPhone, the iApps, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a serious omission, in my opinion.
Well, that's why it doesn't count against your 5 gig limit for your free account, I guess, somehow.
Yeah. You know, right. Yeah. You know. It's outside. It's out of that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I thought you were limited to 1,000 photos and stuff started peeling off the front, especially if you don't forget to go back and get rid of your screen captures.
Well, you are in your default photo stream. Right.
But now you're not.
But but you have to manually put the stuff there.
You do create it there. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That, you know, I can do that.
I know, but why not just let me, if I'm willing to pay for it,
have
especially,
all my photos there. Done.
Just, I want it when I take a picture, done. Now you can do that. Google Plus and Dropbox, the apps, the iOS apps will sync your photos if you tell them to. If you don't, then they won't, but, they will sync your photos just by default up to the cloud. And if you have enough Dropbox storage, you can have all your photos sync there. And the same is true with Google Plus. So, you know, that's the thing that makes me scratch my head. Like, Apple, just open the door. You're first in line.
And I was putzing with BitTorrent Sync yesterday, and BitTorrent Sync has a new feature now for your photos to sync.
Seriously?
Too. Yes. So
you don't have to buy storage for that.
No, you don't. You can, if you put that on your transporter or your Drobo or something like that, there you are, you're unlimited. Now you have to, you have, like anything, you have to be connected.
Yeah.
But yeah
really,
yeah, I was messing with that yesterday. Kept asking me if I wanted to add photos, and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not trying to do that right now. I'm trying to solve another problem.
But
as we started talking about this, it occurred to me that I saw that yesterday.
Yeah,
it,
so
it was,
I
in the iOS app, but it was asking, do you want to do your photos?
Of course,
and,
I do.
And for those that don't know that that I just found out yesterday, BitTorrent Sync has an iOS app.
Yeah.
And
they've got Android apps and iOS apps. Yeah. Now, BitTorrent Sync's an interesting, I'm, like I said, I kind of had my epiphany with it a couple weeks ago.
It's
so.
free money.
It's free money. Yeah. It's good.
I was surprised when I recently got the iPad. I was like, am I going to see my photos in iPhoto on the iPad? And I did.
Mm-hmm.
Because it subscribed through .Mac. You know, or iCloud,
sure,
iCloud stream. And I was like, okay, that, because I wasn't quite sure, which is the way I am with.
How do it know?
Kind of like you, Dave. It's like, you know, is this going to participate as a good citizen in the iCloud universe?
Right.
And it did.
Oh, sure.
I feel bad that I was kind of surprised that it did, because initially I opened up iPhoto on the iPad and there was nothing there. And I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah.
You know, what did I do wrong now?
Yeah, I don't want to make this the rant against Apple for their minor indiscretion show. But however,
okay. However you will.
However, I evidently will.
Here's what I'm going to do.
The one thing is, and it's sort of a big thing, but I will highlight one example of this. iOS 7, especially so compared to iOS 6, And I know you didn't have iOS 6 on an iPad, John, but iOS 7 feels very much like an operating system we designed for the iPhone. And oh, yeah, we're going to give it to you folks on the iPad, too. And the one thing that drives me crazy, but it only drives me crazy when I travel or when I'm sort of in that mode of I want my iPad with me all the time, is I have, like you, John, the T-Mobile iPad, right? So I can use T-Mobile data if I want, but I turn off cellular data. I go into settings and I turn off cellular data for two reasons. Number one, I don't want it to accidentally use my very limited amount. And number two, I don't want to burn my battery at a faster rate. And that happens when you have the cellular chip on. So I turn it off, and except for when I want it on. And, you know, they added the control center to iOS 7. But the one thing that's missing from there is the ability to toggle cellular data. Now, on your phone, that's not something you're going to do all the time. But on your iPad, it's something
absolutely
you do constantly.
You know, I didn't realize I have that same pet peeve, and I didn't even realize it.
Oh, yeah. I got to go to settings.
You're saying you want this ability because the data cap, monthly data cap for the free plan is relatively low. Is that why you're...
No, I want it because I want to be... Because on the iPad, the use case is that we turn this on and off all the time. I don't need my cellular data on all the time. And so I turn it off to save, mostly to save my battery, but yes, also to save that sort of accidental cellular usage.
Yeah.
I haven't run into that use case. What I do use, though, which could be why I don't yet have this use case, is that I run DataMan.
Yeah, but the battery wise, it is, you do run into this problem. Right.
Okay. I'm sure I have.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, there's just, when I'm at home, there's no reason to have the cellular circuit on because it's just yet another radio that doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, right. But like you, I'm sure you have Wi-Fi on, so it doesn't matter, which I do also. I mean,
but both radios are on, right? So if you have, I have Wi-Fi. I'm not talking about using it for data, but if your cellular data is turned on your iPad, you will burn your battery faster. And at times, watch this if you want. But I guarantee you overnight, your data usage on your cellular plan will increase while you're sleeping and doing nothing.
It'll tick, tick. It'll check in on the network.
Even though Wi-Fi is checked in. Yeah, yes. I've noticed that. Yeah, yes. It's like again, I use DataMan, so I'll see it increase by
it's minimal.
Less than a megabyte. Yeah, but it's definitely communicating at some level, though not enough to concern me that I'm going to blow my cap.
No, you're not going to blame. That's why I said it's not it's so much about the cap as it
but
is.
Now you're saying, because I think I see what you're saying. What you're saying is that it's the radio is on.
Yeah.
Maybe not full blast, but it's on. So you're consuming power because you still are communicating using.
And it's even worse if you're somewhere where you're at a signal edge, right? Where the device is constantly trying to recapture a signal. That's when you kill your battery. Big time.
I guess I hadn't noticed also because the iPad compared to my iPhone and even my computer has, I don't know if I've seen it go 8 to 10 hours.
That's about right.
You know, gone at a stretch before I have to think about charging it.
Yeah. But just like I turn off Bluetooth on my iPad when I'm not using it.
Good point.
I would like to turn off
the whole iBeacon thing.
And it's nice to be able to turn it off without actually leaving the app you're in. My use case is I'm sitting at the gate. I may have called up radar and now I'm back and I've got my taxi chart up and, it's time to push. I want to turn off my cellular data. I don't want to back out of my Jepson navigation app to turn off cellular and I don't want to go to airplane mode because I want to leave my GPS on.
Right.
So that I get the moving map. So I'd like to be able to just flick it up, flick off cellular data, flick it out, and not even be leaving my app. And
that's it.
There's no reason they can't put that little toggle in.
No, they could. That's why I said it's just it's just a thing.
That's it. All right. We want more.
Yeah, I know.
Gosh, come on.
All right.
Always waiting, wanting more.
So we had a geek challenge a couple shows ago, and I liked Louis' answer so much that not only did I want to share it, but without even thinking about it, I implemented it on the iMac at home. The Geek Challenge was for a listener who wanted to have fast user switching be enforced so that when his wife sat down at the computer, she would be forced to log into her account without logging him out, so that she would use her email and her bookmarks and her browsing history and all of that stuff. And Louis heard that and said, "Oh, it's built in. You just got to think a little differently." He says, "If you set the computer to go to screensaver or sleep after a certain time, you can force the computer to request the account password to get out of the screensaver or sleep. This is done in the security and privacy preference pane inside system preferences. If there is more than one user set up, you get the little icon to switch users right there at the bottom of the screen. It doesn't show other users if no other user is set up." So it is. You just check the box that says require your password 5 minutes after sleep or screensaver begins. And that's that. And you can have it required immediately, too. So that and I did that at the house and it's been great. because I have the iMac at the house, which I actually had kind of stopped using once I got my Air. But I sort of got my fingers back into that this weekend, and having turning that on was like, great. Now the kids aren't going to accidentally use my account if I left it logged in. They're going to use their own accounts, and we're all clear. So thanks, Louis.
It offers you the account to choose, and then you put your own password. Is that how it works?
Well, actually, what it does is it asks you for the password of the user that was logged in when it went to sleep.
Okay.
But at the bottom of the screen is the checkbox.
That
switches user. That's beautiful. It. Yeah. And you know, I didn't even have to tell the kids about it. I mean, my kids are fairly computer literate. If they're extremely computer literate, let's face it. But, you know, I watched my daughter and she's like, is this computer okay to use? I said, yeah. And she sat down and it asked for my password and she clicked the little box and logged in as her. And
we set that up so that the kids aren't messing up mom's account anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. And then Curtis from show 494 had a little follow up, and it was about unmounting volumes, and he found an unmount volumes preference pane, which is the, well, he finds it easier because it's just a separate pref pane, and it's totally future proofed. It works with everything. He's used it since OS 10 Lion, and the same preference pane just bounces forward with him. No problems at all. So we'll put a link to this preference pane at Red Cliff Technology, but I believe it's $10. So there you go. That's the way it works. I like it. All right. You know, John, you can hear me okay, right? Show's recording okay as far as we know. In fact, if our listeners are hearing this, it is, right?
Did you push the button?
As far as I know, everything is operating according to plan.
So I am taunting the computer gods right now, because I've been complaining for a while that this computer needed an SSD. And even worse is that I've had a 256 gig SSD sitting downstairs on my desk, completely unused. And so earlier this week, I thought, fine, it's time. So I cloned the hard drive in the studio iMac here to an SSD over USB. And that's how I'm running currently. I figured I would test it for a week through the show, make sure everything worked okay. And then I bought one of those newer tech drive adapters to turn it into a 3.5-inch size. So I have to put it inside the iMac. Now, I've never taken apart an iMac before, John, but I have the suction cups. So my son and I have plans to do that some afternoon this week.
Oh, yeah. I definitely would recommend two people. I did it with our pal Duffy.
Yeah.
The other caution here, just to throw this in, since we're talking about iMacs and putting them back together.
Yes.
We did have an email that I do recall. I think you answered it, Dave, but I think we're going to talk about answering it. I don't know if it's a question, but if it's not, you know what I'm talking about. Be careful when you put the screen of an iMac back in so you don't get the OCD dust syndrome.
Yes. Yeah. There's a great video.
If you're not very careful when you put it back together, I mean, the thing is, as soon as you take that screen out, you break the seal, and it's possible for you to get schmutz or gunk or whatever you want to call on the screen, and then it's going to drive you insane when you put it back. So, I mean, I would say as soon as you pull it off, immediately put it on like a felt cloth, or
I don't even know that matters. I think what you need to do.
Well, just put it down on something where there's not something that's going to mess up the screen. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think what that is, whether it be a.
Well, I think you just need to wipe it before you close it back up. You wipe the screen and the inside of the glass is what the.
But you see, my thought is you put it on something that is not tainted in any way and just leave it there until you have to put it back. And yeah, you still could get that errant piece of dust.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also like fingerprint smudges, I think will probably be the worst. That drive me nuts.
But after I had it on the SSD for a day, and it's, I mean, it's night. It literally is night and day. It you know, there's no comparison. When I got up here to the studio, normally what I have to do previously on the spindle drive, I would have to log into this computer 30 minutes ahead of time over my iPad and launch the apps that I would need. Email is probably the worst one. But Skype takes a while to launch on this machine. Just all the apps that I need to record the show. And if I didn't get those launching, 20 minutes before I needed to be up here, we would wait 10 minutes for all that stuff to happen. I got up here 4 minutes before you and I synced up, and I launched all the apps and I was good to go. No problem. Now, the other thing, John, is I figured, well, now that I've got a clone of this thing, I might ought to want to upgrade to Mavericks. So I did. And this machine is now running Mavericks with the new audio drivers. So not only are we doing the hard drive over USB, but audio is over USB now, as well.
Wow.
Now, did you get a USB 3 case?
No. No, my iMac's not USB 3. It's just USB 2.
Yeah. Okay. No, just wondering. All right. Yeah. So, and the performance on USB 2, which is 480 megabits per second. Maybe it's not a bottleneck, but
there's no, it's not about the speed. It's about latency. Right.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But USB 2 is not holding you back, which is good.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure if I was trying to like pump lots of data back and forth, it would matter, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean,
but for day to day.
Yeah.
Or even podcasting, which I would say makes some demands on the system.
Some. Yeah. Yeah. But it's really nice. And I haven't had any of those weird hiccups that I have when I move to the browser or whatever because of the drive delays and all of that. It's just been flawless. So so far, I should be knocking on wood here.
Hey, that hurt.
Yeah, that's right.
Dave, I got something new.
Go.
I'm going to go. And it's going to be real quick here. So when we went out to Macworld, one of our good friends, Mary, gave me a equipment contribution, which is very nice. Thank you, Mary.
Yeah.
So basically, I now have a Airport Extreme fourth generation 802.11n.
Not the AC, right? But the one prior to that, right?
It's two prior.
Okay.
This is a fourth generation.
Okay.
Then they came out with the fifth generation, and I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the difference is. But the thing is, so this one, again, Airport Extreme 802.11n, fourth generation, is dual radio. And it has both a 2.4 gig and a 5 gig 802n radio. Dude, what a difference.
I can imagine.
I think before we concluded that the Time Machine, which is now, as we speak, being recycled because I basically pulled the drive out of it, put it in my Drobo, and put it in the electronics recycling box, and it is now somewhere being torn apart.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I got rid of it because it was just night and day. So before when I did my benchmarks, if you noticed, if I was at a distance, even at 5 gigahertz. So number one, the performance was between 10 and 40 megabits per second.
Abysmal.
Yeah, terrible. And then the Airport Express, you know, did a little better. But then this thing, Dave, so I was at, you know, pretty much a similar location on 5 gig. So number one, the MacBook Pro almost always, which is my machine that's I use on wireless for the most part, always picks 5 gigahertz now.
Oh, which is nice. Right. Yeah.
In addition to all the other equipment in the house. So like my 802.11n adapter on my TiVo, all of a sudden I'm like, wait a second. Why is the LED blue instead of green? On that device, it means, oh, I've chosen 5 gigs. Before, it chose 2.4 because I think
because it was again, just a weak
the characteristics
signal.
Of the time capsule. Yeah. So now I benchmark using iPerf on 5 gigahertz at a relatively far. I'll call it far in my tests.
Sure.
But I'm getting 90 to 100 megabits per second using the Mac. Okay. 90 to 100 versus what I was getting before, which was like 40. So it's picking 5 and it's doing awesome. And then I also took, so Dave, we talked about this device here. Then it got even better. So I have this Bear Extender Turbo and I'm like, you know what? So Bear Extender Turbo is a USB 3 to 802.11 AC device, but it can also do 802.11n.
Sure.
And it has two antennas. And I'm like, you know what? Just for kicks, let me hook that up. With that, Dave, from the same location, I was getting 130 to 140 megabits per second on my local network.
Interesting.
Well, the thing is, it's a powered and I think amplified, transmitter receiver. So even though it's not even doing AC, it's still doing better than the antennas built into the. So I'm just saying kudos to both Apple for making a better.
Well, is it because the Bear Extender Turbo it's 3x3, right? It's got three antennas in it, whereas your Mac only has one or two.
When I ran their software, it said, I've chosen 300 megabits per second, which to me is two right?
By that's
two.
Right. Yep.
So it's saying, okay, this is the maximum I'm going to communicate at. And it gave me, certainly a subset of that. I wasn't expecting.
Oh, because your Airport is only 2x2.
I thought, I looked in Mac.
Oh, no.
It was three.
No,
so
it's 3x3. You're right. I'm looking at the Wikipedia chart.
Now, it could be that the Bear Extender, for whatever reason, is 2x2. I thought it was 3x3.
They're saying it's 3x3.
In detail.
Yeah, but might be a distance. It might be a distance thing. Right. Yep.
Yeah, this was done at a distance, but
yeah.
So again, two things. thank goodness I now have a decent base station and I can see the glory of 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Now, do you want to know that the fifth generation model almost
the four?
It almost doubles the performance in in people's tests. Yeah.
How do they do that? Huh?
I don't know. It's more output power, I think, in terms of milliwatts. Yeah.
Well, I'm still, compared to where I was,
sure,
I'm definitely happier.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. No.
I'm ready for AC if and when it comes, thanks to the bear extender guys.
But you don't have a router that'll do AC.
Not at this point, no.
So it's funny. I have routers that will do AC. In fact, all three of them in the home will do, and the office will do AC. But I don't have a single client. So you should have given me your bear extender thing to test. There you go.
I think they'd probably hook you up too.
That's probably true, actually. Yeah. That's I should ask him. Yeah, because that'd be cool to test.
They make great products.
Yeah. We gave him thanks to you, I'm sure, we gave him a Editor's Choice Award at Macworld last week. So kudos to them.
Agreed. It's cool. And the extender, absolutely. I'm looking forward to that, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta get one of those from him and test it here. That's crazy.
That'll be your turn then, because you definitely have range issues. Compared to me, I mean, I'm in a, small,
well, sort of. I mean, that's why I have three routers set up. So right. I've mitigated range issues. but yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. I want to talk about our second sponsor for the show, John, which is iFixit. They are new to this show, at least in terms of being sponsors. They're certainly not new to this show in terms of being mentioned. We've mentioned them many, many times. So iFixit is the place to go. First of all, if you need, like when I am going to go do this iMac repair, right? That's not a repair. This enhancement where I take this SSD and I put it in to my iMac. I need to buy that newer tech adapter to make the SSD larger so that it fits in the same slot that my hard drive did. Uh-huh. But that's a $15 part, and I already have it. It arrived yesterday. But I need to know how to do this, right? That's sort of the hard part. The 15
it's
bucks
not
is
obvious
easy.
On how to open your iMac, Dave.
Dude, you have to use suction cups, literally suction cups to pull the screen off. Right. I mean, like we talked about,
it's so beautifully built until the point you're at where you're like, how do I open?
How do I get in? And that's what iFixit's great for, is you go there and they have these step-by-step guides. Now, what I do is I print them out. And then I take the screws from each step and tape them to the instructions on that step. So there is no question that I am doing the right thing. And like I said, I was going to have my son help me. And we've done many things, and we always use iFixit's instructions. And so we have a system, and we just tape them down. And that way we know we have the right screws in the right spot, and it works great. And then we just go backwards through the steps to put it back together. Now, you may think, well, that's great, but how do I get the screws out? Well, that's what iFixit's there for, too. They sell 70 different tools to assist you with any modification, malfunction, enhancement, or misfortune that might come your way. Not just with your iMac, but with your laptop and your iPhone and your iPad. They've got all the tools to get these things apart. I know these guys personally. They have a singular focus there. And as soon as they touch a new device, it is, I want to get inside this thing. And so I'm sure now they're better at it even with new devices. I'm sure when they started, they just wrecked these things, but that's okay. They wreck them so you don't have to. And then not only do they give you the instructions, but they sell you exactly the right tools. And yes, that's opportunistic. And it's exactly what they should be doing because they know what they're doing. And so when they sell you a tool and they say, this is what we use to get inside that device, it's because it's what they use to get inside that device. And a lot of these things, they go nuts. They spec their own tools out so that they're exactly what you need for that particular thing. It's not like you're running down to the hardware store and just getting any old, putty knife to use as a spreader to get your iPhone or iPad screen off. You're using one that these guys have spec'd out because they know it works with that device. And the same is true of all their stuff. They've got a 54-bit driver kit with 54 different drivers. They've got Philips bits, large and small, Pentalobe bits for the iPhones and Mac laptops.
Oh, all the I was going to say, Dave, they were one of the first to come to the rescue when Apple pulled the Pentalobe trick.
Yeah.
I was like, thank you guys. And you know, it's a tool to solve this problem.
Even the Phillips bits, right? You know, you can, we all have Phillips screwdrivers in our home, and we're all tempted when we're going and taking apart our laptop to just use whatever Phillips screwdriver we can find to open it up. And those will, if you use the wrong size, you greatly increase your chances of stripping those screws. With these guys, not only you're following their instructions, but if you use their tools, you can use exactly what they've told you and what Apple uses to get in and out of these things. So I really encourage you to check them out. iFixit.com/MGG gets you all the free repair guides you'll ever need. And then when you find that perfect part or tool, make sure you use coupon code MGG at checkout. It gets you $10 off your order of $50 or more. So that's iFixit.com/MGG and make sure you use coupon code MGG at checkout to save yourself $10. So
I got to add something cool about their guides.
Go.
I got to.
Yeah.
They allow you to make comments as you go through. If you know, sure. Like I've replaced an iPhone 4 screen and I'll make comments. And some of the best parts of their guides are user inputs. Hey, if you do this, it will also work. This may save you some time. So they're throughout their guides.
Yep.
It's not only them, but there's other users who have had successes or failures. Hey, don't do this or you're going to buy a new laptop screen,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. So their guides are fabulous.
It's great.
And all user sourced.
Right. So check them out. iFixit.com/MGG. All right, John. We've got some time left. Maybe we should answer some questions today.
Think so?
I do. So we'll answer Brian's question because it's sort of timely. He says, I have a Mac Pro. Wait. This is your question to answer, John. Look at what I'm doing. I'm just plowing ahead.
I'll read it.
I'll read it. You can answer. I have a Mac Pro 2008. 8 gig, 2X quad core, yada, 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 he says. And I am looking, he actually wrote yada, yada, yada. And I am looking at doing a fresh install of Mavericks on a new hard drive that I have in one of my drive bays. What's the best method of doing this? I see a ton of ways to do it on a single drive machine, but was wondering if there's an easy way to do it when there are multiple drive bays available. John?
Two things, Dave. So I think the first thing is that when you do download Mavericks, by default, it's going to want to install itself on the machine that you downloaded it to.
That's right.
Which is obviously not what he wants. So how do you get around this? Well, I suppose you could purchase.
I don't know if
you can do this anymore.
No.
Can you still purchase a Mavericks installer on physical media? I don't think you can.
No, I don't think so. No.
So what do you do in this case? It's mind-boggling. What do you do? Well, what you do is you go to, you make yourself a bootable version of the Mavericks installer. How do you do this? You get Disk Maker 10.
It's an X.
Gonna say X. But
yes.
Do you think it's X?
I don't know.
Because it's OS 10, not OS X. I get cranky about that.
I think you have to say both.
So, and that's at liondiskmaker.com. So this is something that will take, so once you download, so if you go to the App Store, you download Mavericks, don't run the installer.
Well, it'll run automatically, right? But you can just cancel out of it. Yeah.
Well, I just want to say, yeah, don't run the installer, because the problem is if you run the installer, then it erases itself. What you want to do is once you've downloaded it, then you want to run this Lion Disk Maker. And then lo and behold, you will have either, I guess it can do it either on USB media or physical media, like a CD or DVD. Then you will have a Mavericks installer. The only other thing
I don't think it'll work on CD, just so people know. I think it needs more space than a CD. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, CD. Yeah. No. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I think I said DVD.
You said CD or DVD.
Though you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, the installer is definitely bigger than 470 or 650.
Yeah, right.
650 is the limit, right?
Yeah.
Number two.
I don't even know that it'll fit on DVD, to be honest. I know I had that problem.
I fit some of the earlier ones, but sometimes you need a dual layer, which is whatever gigs.
That's right. That's right.
It's annoying because it
just get yourself an 8 gig USB stick and do it that way. It's the easiest way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. And then the other thing is, if you're going to install on a drive where there are multiple drive bays, all I'd say is, as far as I know, Dave, the OS will still let you give multiple drives the same name.
Yeah. Like
you could have two drives called Macintosh HD, which is the default. Sure. All I would say in that case is just, you know, kind of make them a little different.
Right. Yeah.
Because there always is the potential. I mean, normally the installer just says, okay, well, here's, you know, Macintosh HD, and here's another one called Macintosh HD. It may differentiate, or it will definitely, by the type of connection, and that it may have a FireWire or USB or whatever.
Sure.
But yeah, I wouldn't want to play Russian roulette with guessing which of those is the right drive. So yeah, before you undertake this procedure, make sure that you name them in a sensible manner.
You know, I was kind of a dum-dum when I updated this machine to Mavericks. I just let it do it from the App Store. Even though I have a USB stick downstairs, I didn't even think about it until right now. Like, oh, I could have saved myself the bandwidth, but since Comcast doesn't limit me at the moment, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I have installers, Dave, for probably the last three versions of OS X, just because, just in case.
Oh, yeah. I store them on my
boxes. It's like those boxes that we all have in the attic.
Oh, dude.
I need it just in case.
I know. I love those boxes.
Now, you have a wife that can yell at you about that. I don't.
That's right. Well, this is a reason that I have a separate building with my office.
You might move in 20 years. You'll need those boxes.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when I do those, I keep some of those boxes with the piles of iPhone cases. And so when the validity of when the wisdom of keeping these boxes is called into question, I just pull out the box of iPhone and iPad cases and say, is it time to upgrade, dear? And then we're good to go. So it deals with that problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Or Pete comes over Kiwi and goes, you got any cases, Dave?
Exactly.
Kiwi Graham does have a good point. You may at points, and actually I've done this in the past. There is a case for re-downloading an OS installer in that you may get a point release
yes,
increase.
That's right. Now,
and I think I have that. So I think I have Lion 10, you know, whatever .1 or .2, and then for other OSs. So that's a good point. That's a case, though. Again, as you said, Dave, I mean, if you have a data cap, you don't want to be doing these multi-gig downloads all the time.
Now, I haven't tested this with Mavericks yet, but I believe it to still be true. It certainly was true with Lion when we first started getting stuff from the Mac App Store and installers that way. If you have the installer on your hard drive and you do the update to Mavericks, it updates the installer too. Or it did the update to Lion. It also updated, I would extract that, you know, install.esd disk image or whatever, or install esd.dmg file and save it not on my hard drive, but on my network drive. And if that network drive was mounted, that install ESD disk image would get updated when I did my my OS updates. Scared the heck out of me that it went and found it like in a subfolder out there. So
your NSA working for you.
Yeah. It was like, whoa. So
it's watching.
Yeah. So you can keep that stuff up to date, which is why I keep them on my network drive, because I figure, well, I'm just going to embrace this. It's just how it's going to be. So, all right. Scott writes, gents, there are many methods and apps that can show how much space various files are taking up on a hard drive. That's helpful. But what I really want to know is what a hard drive is currently doing or has done. There are many times when I'll hear the drive working, but cannot determine what activity is taking place. In the process of analyzing this, I've closed all applications, suspended things like Dropbox and syncing processes, and yet the drive is still working. It's a mystery. Certainly, it could be attributable to a lot of different things, but there doesn't seem to be a simple way to see what a list of what files the drive has been reading and writing. I've checked the console and the Mac App Store, and nothing obvious pops up there either. Do you know of any way or any app that would simply show me a list of activity along the lines of, at such and such a time, file name XYZ was written to the drive? I'm sure, in fact, he says, I can't be the only one that would like to know this. Something must exist somewhere that would facilitate this, but I can't find it. Okay. So let's pass this one around. You know, the activity monitor will show you some of this data. If you go to the disk tab of Maverick's activity monitor, it shows you what apps have written data, and how much they've read and how much they've written, but it directly doesn't show you what files they are currently writing. However, you can dig a little deeper, and if you double click on an app in Mavericks, in the activity monitor, and this is true of other of previous activity monitors too, you see a detail on the app, and there's three tabs: memory, statistics, and open files and ports. If you go to open files and ports and scroll down to the bottom, I can see, for example, that on this computer, in my home folder, in a folder that I have labeled test, which is really a bad name for it, since it is the folder that the podcast file is actively saved to, I can see that Audio Hijack Pro is writing a file called MGG Direct 2014.0406.2.AIFF. And that is exactly as I have told it to do to save this file. And if you're hearing this, then it means that that has worked and me mucking about with it didn't mess anything up. So that's one way of seeing it, but it's not giving you your list. iStat Menus also has a disk usage tab, and you can see the activity on any given disk, which is interesting. But again, it's not showing you the exact files. So, John, any thoughts from you?
So you, what you're telling me is you'd like to see the files that are being written to.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
You know what? I think there's a Unix command that can do that. And I think it's called LSOF. I'm going to guess LS is like the Unix LS command, which lists thing. And I'm going to guess OF stands for open files.
I'll buy that. Yeah.
So it's a place to start. Oh, absolutely. If you type LSOF in the terminal. Now, the problem is, well, number one, if you run it in the terminal, you're running it in the terminal. Duh. I mean, it's going to be all text and sure, kind of meaningless. Wouldn't it be great if somebody wrote a utility that would let you parse that data and maybe offer it in a GUI, Dave?
Yes.
Here it comes.
Well, our buddy Sveinbjorn Thordarson, I think I got that right.
I think you did.
A utility called, I think I got that right.
But LSOF is not bad because it shows you the name of the application and what files has open. That's right. Yeah.
But here's my tip is that if you run this utility called sloth, well, then you get a GUI on top of it.
Hang on, John.
Searches.
Hang on, John. I don't know what I did. Okay, we're back. The recording's going here. That was interesting. Yeah. So evidently running LSOF
while recording a podcast is not recommended.
I typed it, John, and it paused, and I thought, nope, I'm not going to do it. And so I hit Control C and stopped it. But it was clearly too late. And things, all right. Well, where things I went left south off, from there.
Well, I think you caught this part, but there is a GUI version of this. So, yeah, I think you should have sat on your hands and maybe tried to run the GUI version of this.
Well, maybe not, because it probably still runs LSOF. But
really? Okay.
I would imagine.
But yeah, there is a utility by Sveinbjorn. You can read it. Anyways, we'll put the link in our notes here. But it's called Sloth, maybe because LSOF is such a sloth.
Well, yeah. Or it's, I saw it as a nice little juxtaposition of the letters of LSOF, right?
LSOF.
Right. Take it back, twist it around.
Except there's no F in there, but
yeah, but it's, you know, you call it sloth or you call it sloth. I like it.
Or loth. Or, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. Yeah. That's fun. All right. All right. So now I got to get my agenda back up here, John. We everything got all crazed.
Compobulated.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Let's jump around a little bit here. I like that one. That was good. That was good. Yeah. So this is a good one. So Adam wrote, and Adam had a very interesting question. He says, I have two Apple TV units, a Gen 1 and a Gen 2. I also have a YouTube account attached to a Gmail address. He says, which I have enabled two-factor authentication on. He says, I had to do a factory restore of the Gen 1 Apple TV, And afterwards, I was unable to log into the YouTube account. It would not accept my password. I then did a silly thing. I changed the password for that account on Google. This, of course, broke my login on the Gen 2 Apple TV. And now neither of them will log into YouTube. How can I regain access to my account on these Apple TVs? I want to keep two-factor authentication. I'd like to protect all the Google services I have attached. I'm tired of manually searching for my favorite channels. And these units are not capable of accepting video AirPlay from my iPad or iPhone. What to do? So two-factor authentication, the way this works is, for those of you that don't use it, Google has it, Apple has it. And essentially what you do is, once you enable this, you have to enter your password. That's one factor. And then it asks you for, when you're logging into Google, it's going to ask you for something else. With Google, it's typically a code that's generated by the iOS app or the Android app called Google Authenticator. And you sync all this up when you enable two-factor authentication, and it works really well. And that way it keeps people from guessing or hacking your password and then being able to get into your account. It's a great idea and really enhances security. However, in order for this to work, all the places where you log in have to now support this second factor of authentication. On the web, that's easy because Google controls the whole widget. But like, for example, with BusyCal, they had to update BusyCal. They did. They did it very, very quickly. So that you're presented with this web view that allows you to do this second factor. The software on your Apple TVs do not allow this. The software that you use for your email does not allow this on iOS, or, you know, the built-in mail app on iOS or the built-in mail app on OS X. So there needs to be a way to get around this. And what you do is you go in and you generate what Google in this case calls application specific passwords. And you go in and you say, I need a password for my Apple TV. And we'll put a link in the show notes that details the path. But you go into Google and you click account and you go to security. You go to two factor and you say application specific passwords. You generate a new password, and then that password displays on the screen. You type it in and that's it. It disappears off the screen after you've done it from your web browser, and that's it. But it works the old way, and it is a password that is good for your account. So it does open up a slight security hole, because if someone hacks that password, and it's a big long string that hopefully someone couldn't hack, but it does open up that hole. But that's the way that you're going to make this work. And we'll put a link in the show notes that explains the specific path to get there. But that's what you need to do, is the application specific password. And it is the way to do it. So that's how this works. Do you do two-factor authentication, John?
No.
Really?
No.
Why not?
There. I just did two-factor.
Very nice.
No. 'Cause it's too complicated to set up.
It's really not that bad. I do it, and I'm less security conscious than you are, I would think.
I'm security conscious.
That's what I'm saying.
Into two-factor.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's inconvenient. See, I'm on the go, man. I can't take this extra time to authenticate another factor. What?
Yeah.
You don't see this?
I get it. I'm with you.
Yes.
Yes.
I use those as specific passwords, and they say, don't worry about remembering them, but it's a pain in the butt to go back and get it again. Mm-hmm. So I take that, it gives you that long key, and I take it and I actually put it in my 1Password in the notes section so I can go back.
I do too.
And go, what did I get for mail? What do they have for?
What's cool is you can expire individual app specific passwords. So if you look at, like, I go in every now and then when I have to create a new one, I look at my old ones, and if I see one that I haven't used in a while, yeah, I expire it. Like, if it hasn't been logged in the last week, it's I'm not using it. So, yeah. It's good. All right, John, you want to tell us about John?
Oh, no. Really?
All right, then let's skip John.
No, we can do John. I just have to bring John before me. Now, would this be John as in John that wants to know about? What does John want to know about? I want to make sure I got the right John.
I'll tell you what. I'll read John's question.
Of course. Yes, I see his question.
John says, as mentioned in your last episode, pulling down on the notification shade. Where are we here? Yeah. Should show you how long and I see. Okay. So putting it in context. Yeah. So, he says, you mentioned in your last episode that pulling down on the notification shade in iOS would show you how long it would take you to drive home. He said, I looked and mine doesn't, no matter where I am. Any ideas as to why?
Absolutely. You have to go to multiple places, Dave, and I had to do a bit of digging for this. So, the first place you want to go to is settings, privacy, location services, system services. We're almost there. Frequent locations on. In that list of frequent locations, you will see one that's marked as home. That gives you a warm fuzzy that you know the home thing is working. If you don't see something marked as home, then where you want to go to is settings, mail, contacts, calendars, my info. Within that screen, you're going to see one item that is identified as your home address. Or you will see a contact identified, and then within that contact, make sure that your home address is listed and your work address.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And then the third one is settings, privacy, location services, system services, traffic on.
I like it.
And I think that's it. And then I think actually there's another one. If you go into the maps preferences, I think you can decide whether you want it to show you distances in driving or walking. Because especially in a city, you may not be driving. You're going to be walking from point A to point B.
Sure. So, sure.
I believe those are all the touch points. If anybody knows of any extras, because it is kind of obscure.
Yeah.
That you're either going to see this stuff or you won't. And it doesn't give you any guidance. I have not found an article from Apple that gives you guidance on how to enable this feature. It just kind of is a pleasant surprise, but it's unpleasant in the fact that people don't know how.
So are you saying that Apple doesn't have an article that gives you guidance on how to get guidance?
I believe that's my guidance. Yes.
That's your guidance. That's awesome. All right. Listener Dave has a pesky issue with his Google account too. He says, I'm mailing you about this crazy experience that is mail on the Mac with Gmail. No, don't worry, folks. We're not going to spend a half hour ranting about that, too. He says, the last couple of days, this is very specific. Last couple of days, I've noticed something strange happening. As I compose an email, it seems that mail is quietly taking a copy of the email about every 30 seconds and dumping it into my trash folder. So if I take 5 minutes typing an email before I send it, then I will have 10 incomplete copies of the email in my trash folder, timestamped at 30-second intervals. It's really weird. It's not happening with the same account on my iOS devices, so I guess it's something happening with Mac Mail only. Says it's even happening right now as I type this message on my Mac. What's happening? Well, what's happening is Mail and Gmail don't exactly play perfectly together. We've talked about this, and I promised we weren't going to go too deep into a rant about that. But that's sort of the crux of this. And what you when you are creating a message in Mail, it creates a draft message, and then you can save that draft so that you don't have to send it, but you can come back to it later on. You have a choice as to where Mail saves that draft. It can save it locally, so it's only accessible from your Mac, or you can have it save it to the Mail server. This is a standard IMAP function. But as we all know, Gmail doesn't really quite play by standard IMAP rules, hence the problem. So what you and the nice part about saving drafts to your IMAP server is if you start composing on your Mac, you could then complete the composition from, say, your iPad or another Mac or your iPhone or whatever you want, or any machine. Right. It's a standard, but it doesn't work quite well. As you're seeing it, there's this issue of it saving drafts constantly and deleting them and this whole thing. So to solve this, you just need to tell Mail to save drafts, not on Gmail, but to save them locally. And the way you do that is you go into Mail, go into preferences, go into accounts, go into mailbox behaviors and choose the account, your Gmail account that you're having this issue with. And uncheck the box that says store draft messages on the server and then close that window. It'll ask you if you want to save the changes and say yes. And then that will do it for you. So that's the issue. It's just one of those things. It's a feature that you can't use if you want to use Gmail and don't want to have a mess of old drafts floating around. So that's all we got. That's how it works. That's how we go. So that'll teach me to start mucking about with the, I said it earlier in the show. Mm-hmm. If you're hearing this, it's because it worked. Well, we know that it didn't work.
Kind of worked.
Yeah, kind of worked. Yeah, yeah.
Partially.
Makes it fun. Keeps it interesting. And we like that.
But Dave, if you want to give us some work, you know what you could do?
What can you do?
Well, not you, but you as in the people listening. Not
yes,
you.
You.
But
right.
What you could do is you could take your comments, concerns, questions, or anything else that you can document and put it in an email and send it to feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's feedback@macgeekab.com, John.
I don't know. What is Pete then?
You're making me hungry. Oh, no. Feedback. Feedback@macgeekab.com.
That's right. That's right. If you are a premium member, you can send us email to premium@macgeekab.com, and we do prioritize the stuff in there, although we do try to get to everything. And even after Macworld, I think we succeeded. We got to every question and flushed out the boxes as of Friday morning, which is what we try to do. So you can also call us at 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. You can find us on the web. MacGeekGab.com is where the show notes go. Links to all of the various things that we do there. Links to find out about premium. All of that good stuff. But if you don't want the links, if you just want to go there directly on Twitter, you can find us at MacGeekGab is the show. John F. Braun is him. Pilot Pete is this guy. Mac Observer is where all the headlines from TMO are posted. And of course, I'm Dave Hamilton right there on Twitter. Where else can they find us, John?
Oh, there's the Facebooks, or the Facebook, or a Facebook, our Facebook site, Facebook.com/MacGeekab.
That a boy.
One of the sites you can find us at. There's another one, Dave. I think this G Plus thing.
Yeah. Plus.google.com/the plus sign MacGeekab podcast, because they make it difficult and that's fun. But we do have that linked from the MacGeekab.com page as well. So, and of course, MacGeekab.com/stream is where we broadcast the show as we're recording it. If you want to be a part of that in the chat room, it's always fun. Nice to have some of you here. Makes things interesting. I do want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this show to AAC, adds all the chapters that we know you folks love. He was having a blast at Macworld Expo, Macworld iWorld, I suppose to call it, with people coming up, you folks coming up and saying, "Hey man, thanks." So he really didn't believe me when I said, "Oh no, this is a valuable service, my friend." So thank you, Michael. It's great. Also want to thank Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Let's see, the podcast marketplace, all the folks that advertise here and love you as our listeners. That includes barebones.com, Smile at smilesoftware.com, Gazelle at gazelle.com, squarespace.com/MGG being the link there. Rage Software, of course, with Everwell. And iFixit on board now at iFixit.com/MGG. What else do we have going on here, John? Anything special happening?
No.
You've got suspicion yourself in the chat room. And years and years, decades ago, he gave me some advice. Actually, it was advice he gave to a ski lift operator. But really? But this advice has lasted with us for all these years. John, you want to share what that advice is?
I think the advice is always don't get caught.
Made up.